Hi everyone, and welcome to Game of Thrones and Medievalism, a podcast created for a fourth-year history course at the University of Northern British Columbia.
In this podcast, our goal is to think about Game of Thrones in the context of medievalism. That is, how the Middle Ages is constructed on Game of Thrones and what that can tell us about our own society and its views of the past. Our topic today is race and racism on Game of Thrones, exploring how ideas of race are constructed and represented on the show, and how they are embedded with contemporary stereotypes. My guest is Dr. Charlotte Carroll, who earned her PhD in English Literature from Middle Tennessee State University. Her interest in how fantasy literature used the Middle Ages accidentally turned into an expertise in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Fire and Ice, and its TV adaptation, Game of Thrones. She is currently working on a book on medievalism in the works of Neil Gaiman and publishes monthly mini-essays on medievalism in fantasy at shilohcarroll.wordpress.com. Shiloh, first of all, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this podcast. I really appreciate your willingness to share your expertise on the topic of medievalism and race in Game of Thrones, but just on Game of Thrones in general. Your work has been so important for helping me think about how I'm going to teach this course.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm going to jump right in. Discussions of race have played a really prominent part in how Game of Thrones has been explored, not only in popular media, there I've read tons and tons of stuff on it, but also within academic work. And this has happened really since the beginning of the show. So why do you think this is such an important topic to think about race in the context of Game of Thrones?
Oh, so many reasons. Stories and media are how we process the world and show people how we see it. And when shows like Game of Thrones fall into these lazy and well-worn and harmful stereotypes about non-white races and cultures, I think it's really important that we push back on that, especially when the showrunners and George R.R. Martin are out here telling everyone that their story is more realistic, it's more historically accurate, it's more like the real Middle Ages than, say, the Wheel of Time or the Lord of the Rings. So people take them at their word and they go around and believe that the Middle Ages looked like Game of Thrones, which is, of course, wrong. So part of what we're doing by pointing out these problems is pushing back on that realism issue. And part of it is an attempt to decolonize popular medievalism, as Dr. Kavita Mudanfin has put it, which overall popular medievalism has a race problem.
And I think that the point of realism is really important. I can't tell you the number of times that I've met people and I mention I'm teaching a course on Game of Thrones. And often people will say to me, well, yeah, I mean, it was, that's what it was really like, right? Like, Middle Ages was really like. And I'm like, well, no, it's not. It's a fantasy. And they immediately get their back up and you don't know what you're talking about. So I'm a medieval historian.
The two of us here who has a doctor in front of their name.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we engage with thinking about how these shows, people think they represent real history. And I think overall, this is partially why I think it's really important to teach a course like Game of Thrones and medievalism, and why I actually use a lot of popular culture, contemporary popular culture in my courses, because I help students think about how popular media represents the past, right? So how students need to engage with that, because most people, that's how they intersect with history, with medieval history in particular. So when I was doing some reading about Game of Thrones more broadly, I came across an article that argued that historians need to stop talking about the show and we shouldn't discuss it at all. And the author gave two comments. One, actually, there's a few different articles about this, but one I looked at, they said, one, it isn't medieval anyway, so why are we talking about it in the context of medieval history? And two, that it reinforces this idea of the Dark Ages, of the medieval period as this time period of barbarism and where women had no rights and it was all awful and everyone lived under a rock. So what do you think about a comment like that?
I think that fantasy literature can be a great gateway drug to studying the Middle Ages in however that looks, because we can study the Middle Ages as historians, as literature people, as somebody interested in arms and armor, and there's religious scholars, dozens of ways that we can study the Middle Ages and come at it. And I mean, I don't think I know a single medievalist whose gateway drug wasn't some sort of fantasy literature, Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, or in my case, Tamara Pierce and that kind of thing. So it's important to talk about where people are getting these ideas and then kind of go from there. That, I mean, this is a very nice story. But if you want to look at real history, here's where we can look at it. I think Game of Thrones in particular can give us that, because Martin's like, oh, I'm looking at the Hundred Years' War. I'm looking at the Wars of the Roses. And then you can go, here is a book on the Wars of the Roses, if you want to kind of see where his inspiration was coming from. And then they can learn actual medieval history, just jumping off from this interest in this particular fiction.
Yeah, which to me is much more interesting, right? And much more full of these gray spaces and nuances and things that fiction might not necessarily pick up on or explore. So yeah, I think a lot of my students say to me, I'm taking your medieval history course because I watch this show or I like this book. Or I'm like, that's great. Let's see what's really going on. Can we get a sense of that?
And back to that one person, they're saying we shouldn't talk about it. I think at that point you kind of cede control to the popular thing, if you're not saying this is great, this is a great story, but inaccurate to actual medieval history. So let's talk about how it's inaccurate to actual medieval history. Instead, you're just letting Game of Thrones suck up all the air in the room.
Yeah. And also think about why people believe that this is real. And to me, that's such a fascinating question, right? Like why? Mm-hmm. And that's why I think thinking about race is so crucial for understanding that.
Absolutely.
That concept, but also the show in general. So a lot of the work that's come out about Game of Thrones and thinking about how they represent race has been very critical of them. So what are some of the key concerns that they highlight in these articles?
I think very broadly, it comes down to two main things. It's a combination of a lack of representation of non-white people and problematic representation of these people. So there were only kind of a handful of people of color in the main cast. And by the end, we only had two. And then they murdered one of them. And the rest of them were either slavers or faceless hordes. I think we had one pirate. We had Salador Saan, who is lovely and needed more screen time, in my opinion. So we had faceless hordes of slaves or the Dothraki or, you know, whoever. And a lot of pop culture critics have pointed out that if you only have one or two women or people of color or queer people or whatever, how you treat them in the narrative becomes how you treat all of those people in the narrative, which means that what happens to Miss Sandy, who was by that point the only named woman of color on the show, becomes by default what happens to all women of color on the show. And it was terrible the way that they treated her. Helen Young, who's, I don't know if you guys are reading any of Helen Young's stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. She has pointed out that Game of Thrones doesn't pass the DuVernay test, which is kind of like the Bechdel test, but for racial minorities.
Yes, we talked about the Bechdel test, actually, and the DuVernay test a little bit a few weeks ago, and we had a long discussion about thinking about female friendships and the fact that the only female friendships that are represented on the show are between Dany and Miss Sandy, and then they kill Miss Sandy.
Yeah.
And then there's no exploration of that type of relationship as well. So yeah, I think it's really troubling the way that these characters are often just this horde of people, right? And there's no distinction between any of them. Whereas the white characters, we get very clear personalities and very clear relationships with each other. And so I'm kind of leading into my next question. So why is this representation of race and racialized characters so troubling on this show? And obviously I think we clearly agree it is troubling, so.
Yes. Oh, again, so many reasons. So David Benioff and Dan Weiss went right to the stereotypes of hypersexualization, hyperviolence, barbarism. And I think the Dorne storyline is where we can see that the most clearly. So David and Dan took from the books the idea that Dorne is a more liberal, more permissive society, and kind of chewed it up and spat it back out and gave us Oberyn and Ilaria as insatiably sexual. And Oberyn is prone to fits of rage. And then it seems like they just didn't know what to do with Dorne anymore, and they just wiped out the whole storyline. But we also get that with the Dothraki, who are prone to rape and hyper-masculine displays of violence. And Dany's whole storyline for the first six seasons is her saving Essos from slavery. But what ultimately happens is she's gathering up all of these groups of non-white people to do her fighting for her when she returns to Westeros. I saw an article from Matthew Iglesias who raised the question of why the Dothraki would even go with her. Because yes, the narrative ignores that they're an entire culture with their own way of life, and it turns them into tools for Dany. And then they're such a faceless horde that we don't even know how many she has, Dothraki or Unsullied. Especially between the long night with the Battle of Winterfell, when we see what looks like her entire Dothraki force die. And then the bells, she's got more from
there. Somewhere.
And she sacks King's Landing with them, which then turns into a whole visual issue with the brown barbarians massacring the white women and children while, you know, our heroes, Jon Snow and the other Northerners are like, oh, what is happening? And are showing restraint and second guessing Grey Worm's orders. And it looks so bad, you guys.
Yeah, especially that particular scene where Grey Worm is lining all the Lannister up, yeah, and the actor, his body language and everything is so, like, it's like he snapped, right? And there's no way that he can go back. I'm in the process of hoping that eventually the book six will come out. I don't know about that. But yeah. So I've been rereading the books while I'm watching the show, which I don't know if that's a good idea. And I'm in book four right now. Mm-hmm. And the removal of all those complexities of the Dorne storyline is so upsetting.
It really is.
Because there's so many rich things going on there, right? In terms of the relationships between the different people in and the Martell family and their intersections with thinking about the other noble houses in Westeros. And yeah, I agree. I think they just don't know what to do with those characters, right?
I think the second we didn't get Arianne, I was like, uh-oh.
Yes.
Where are we going with this? Oh, we're just going to kill all of them. Okay.
And so, I mean, this is kind of a follow-up question, but why do you think they did that? Like, why do you think they just said, we're not going to go there?
I think it may just have been too complex for what they were trying to do, because they left out Varys and Illyrio's entire plot with Aegon, supposedly Young Griff. I had to really carefully not say Fagon and Young Grift right there, because all of the podcasts I listen to call them that. But they took that whole thing out, and then it didn't make, I guess, wouldn't have made sense to have Arianne and her stuff in there. And then it just got so messy. And I think they were just like, all right, we're past the books now. This is our show now. We don't have to do anything that the books say. So we're just going to, because that seemed to be the season where they just started hemorrhaging characters. It got almost funny because it was like seven deaths in the first like three episodes.
I think it's a missed opportunity, because including a fuller representation of Dorne and how that storyline went would have really helped them make these representations of race much more complex.
Absolutely. And if they hadn't gone with what they did with the Sand Snakes, with the hypersexualization and the hyperviolence, and it's all about revenge. Yeah, I think it could have been a lot better.
I find what happens to the Dothraki in The Long Night so frustrating, because as you said, she somehow got this group of warriors who everyone fears to just convince them to come over to Westeros when they really don't care, and they're crucial to her success. But as you talked about, there's sort of this faceless horde in the end, and their sacrifice is never really questioned in The Long Night. It's like, I guess we're just going to send them off and they're all going to die. And nobody. So in a later episode of our podcast, I'm going to talk to a friend of mine who is a historian of modern genocide. And we're going to talk about the question of genocide in Game of Thrones later on. Because I think that's something that really needs to be explored. So This course is called Game of Thrones and Medievalism. My students actually, the first time I taught the class, my students really struggled with the concept of medievalism. So this time I took a different tack and I talked to a friend of mine who's a medievalismist and had her take the students through what this meant. So how can we explore race as an example of medievalism then?
Okay. Well, I mean, if you've already talked to somebody about what medievalism is, that's good. That saves me a little bit of explaining. But medievalism is very much about how we as modern people construct our idea of the Middle Ages and project ourselves and our culture and our anxieties back onto them. So it's one reason that I talk very little about whether A Song of Ice and Fire is accurate or realistic to the Middle Ages, because it by default isn't and can't be. So all of that is really beside the point. So instead, what we have to look at is what we believe about the Middle Ages, why, and what that says about us, because it says nothing about them and everything about us. So there's a tendency for people to think that the European Middle Ages were entirely white and male, and you might occasionally get a woman doing something cool like Joan of Arc or Eleanor of Aquitaine. But I mean, look at how the history books talk about Eleanor of Aquitaine. It's pretty
awful. Well, and I was going to say, Eleanor of Aquitaine was my gateway into the Middle Ages. So yeah, that I read a book about her that a popular historian wrote, actually.
But if you suggest that people of color existed in Europe before like 1700, some people get very defensive. There's a whole conversation going on in medieval studies right now about whether or not Anglo-Saxon is actually a term that we want to be using, partly because it was created post-Middle Ages by people who were trying to say, look at this great white past heritage that we have. So if we say, actually, the Middle Ages and even England wasn't all white Anglo-Saxony, it interferes with people's idea that whiteness has a heritage going back to this idealized time when men were knights and women were kept in towers and they knew their place, which is, of course, bullshit.
Yes.
But it's so entrenched in the cultural consciousness, thanks to the Victorian medievalists. And I think just about any modern medievalist you talk to will go, fucking Victorians, man. They ruined everything. But it's so important to some people's identity that it can be really difficult to set that record straight. So having people of color in a medievalist setting is one step towards that, but you also have to be really conscious of how you're portraying them. And Game of Thrones was not.
So there's lots of things that you commented on here that I want to pick up on. The first time I taught this course, my students expected that we were going to sit down and we were going to spend week after week interrogating the historical accuracy of Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And the first class, I was like, okay, so if that's what you think we're going to do, it's not accurate. Our class is over, right? Like, we're done.
That was really quick.
Yeah, it was really fast, the whole semester. But I think it's much more interesting to think about it through the lens of medievalism. And eventually they kind of grasped that, but I think they had a hard time with it initially.
It's kind of a hard concept. It makes sense. I mean, I had trouble when I first started doing it too. And my dissertation director kept having to turn around and go, no, what you're doing right now is a form of medievalism by trying to argue that it's okay that this is in here because it is historically accurate. But yeah, it took me a little bit to wrap my head around it also.
Yeah, there's been some such great work that's been done explaining what it means as a term now and how we can think about it as both from a variety of different contexts I have a much better understanding now, and they do as well. So one aspect of that many of our course readings have highlighted is how people of color are orientalized and essentialized in Game of Thrones. So can you kind of unpack some of these ideas for us? How can students use this framework of orientalism and race essentialism to examine race in Game of Thrones? And we are reading your chapter from your book, and we've read some other things that talk about this, but I think it would be helpful for them to have a kind of a framework to think about.
Sure. So the show treats the people of Westeros as kind of a default setting, and the people of Essos, and not less Sothros. We never really get there or see very many people who might have come from there, but definitely Essos as kind of the other, capital O, other. That manifests in different ways, either through mysticism or barbarism. Matt Hardy has said that non-white, non-Western cultures have a reputation for senseless cruelty and excessive bloodletting. And that definitely shows up in Game of Thrones. It's like slavery is outlawed in Westeros. But there's definitely an argument to be made that the feudal system isn't that far off of slavery, and the Ironborn practice of taking thralls is slavery. But the show didn't really set that up or unpack it really at all. They left out a lot of the stuff that the lower classes were struggling with that shows up in the books. So instead, we end up with this idea that somehow the white Westerosi are more noble and advanced than the Essosi because they've recognized that slavery is bad. And then Daenerys has to go in and enforce that on the people of Slaver's Bay and teach the Dothraki not to be raping marauders for their own good somehow.
Well, and that brings up the episode that we're looking at for this particular week, which is episode 30, Mhisa, and Dany's sort of representation as a white savior freeing the slaves. So we are, as I mentioned before, we're reading a chapter from your monograph, Medievalism in a Song of Fire and Ice in Game of Thrones. And in that chapter, you talk about this episode as kind of representing the visual effect of slavery. So what kinds of questions should students be asking in their examination of this episode and its visual effect of slavery?
Interestingly, I just read that chapter again, the chapter where that happens in the books with Daenerys freeing Yunkai and riding through them on her silver horse and that whole... Yeah. And I realized that thanks to the show, I have this faceless sea of brown people in my head now. And I was like, no, Martin specifically says that there are lots and lots of different racially coded people. And we'll definitely get to that, I think, a bit later.
Yeah.
But I think in the West, particularly in America, our idea of slavery is based in the African slave trade, which puts in our heads that slaves are by default of color. So in the books, Martin bases his system much more on the Greeks and the Romans. So the slaves that Dany encounters in the books are of all races, even some Westerosi. And not everyone from Essos is brown. The Lyseni are very white. So there's a lot more diversity among the slaves in the books, but for the show, partially because of where they were filming and partially because I don't think they were really thinking about what they were doing, ended up with only people of color cast as slaves. And then you add into that that Dany is the blondest girl in the world and out here telling an entire continent how they should live. And the subtext of white savior very quickly turned into text, especially in that scene at the end of that episode.
We're reading Helen Young's article on the public medievalist, where she talks about that too. And that article has a still image of Dany being lifted up. Yeah. And it's just so visually striking in a really troubling way, yeah. Right? And I think people just don't think about it because they expect she saved these slaves. And so she's this supposed to be this great person. But the way that they have represented slavery as only people of color, I think really, again, it removes those gray areas that I think are so important to think about, right? Mm-hmm. My students have a hard time too when we do talk about the history of slavery, and that's what their image is people of color. And they're always surprised when I talk about, well, no, being a slave wasn't necessarily tied to your skin color in the medieval period. It wasn't until later on.
And it wasn't necessarily permanent, and all sorts of stuff that we don't think about when because of the African slave trade.
Yes, and that slaves had legal rights, and we have all this evidence of it. And so do you think that unconsciously the producers thought, we have to think about, like, this is what slaves were like, or do you think it's just because of where they were and where they were filming?
It's kind of a confluence of things. Yeah. I think they were thinking, we're in Essos, everyone in Essos is brown, and we're shooting in, was it Morocco at that point?
I think so, yeah.
It may have been, yeah. So we're shooting over here, so all of the extras that we can get are of color, and it's too expensive to ship in some of our extras from Ireland, I guess, and they just didn't consider that this looks really bad, you guys.
I think they could have spent a lot more time thinking about so many different threads.
I mean, I come down over and over, if they'd had a writer's room at all, and if they'd had women and people of color in the writer's room, somebody would have said, guys, maybe we should do it this way instead, or we should think about the optics of what this looks like. But since like 90% of the episodes were just David and Dan writing it themselves, I don't think they thought about it too much, because they're both white men and they might just not consider these things.
Yes, I think that highlights the importance of having a diverse group of writers, right, that can bounce ideas off. And again, I think that brings in those nuances that are so important to study, to understanding and thinking about these questions. Mm-hmm. So alongside your book chapter and Helen's article, we're also, our main course book is The Devil's Historians by Amy Kaufman and Paul Sturtevant. And so we're reading two chapters for this particular week, one on white supremacist knights and the other on the class of civilizations. And I chose this book because one of the key themes of our course is challenging this representation of medieval Europe as a white masculine utopia, and why people think it is like that. So how does Game of Thrones work to support that representation? I think we've talked about this a lot already, but how is whiteness kind of explored in this show?
Yeah, and I think we have kind of hashed through some of that a lot already, but white is kind of the default in Game of Thrones, mostly because Westeros is pretty homogeneously white, which makes no sense, but it's somehow barely touched by the rest of the world. Although there's clearly travel between Westeros and everywhere else. People travel all the time. The only reason it took Dany so long was she had to get a whole lot of people onto some ships, and she couldn't get that many ships. But everybody else is just, I'm going to go to Braavos and I'm going to go over here. And it's not hard. So of course there would be more cultural exchange, I think, in Westeros than we're shown. But also we're asked to relate to and sympathize with and forgive for bad behavior the white characters far more than the characters of color, who are lucky if they even get names.
And if they do get names, then they're killed, right? Yeah.
I
mean, that's the...
Yes. I think Grey Worm is the only character of color, named character of color, who comes out of, who manages to survive the whole thing.
And I was thinking about the very end of the show, the last episode where they have all the various noble families all kind of laid out right at the end. And like, it's such a bad, like there's the Prince of Dorne and that's it. Yep.
Right? And it's like, why is he here?
Yes. And he's portrayed in such a negative way, right? Like he comes off as looking kind of this like very weak character, right?
Oh, that whole scene.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe we should try democracy. Lol, sit down, shut up.
What? Yeah, I don't know. We're going to get what? So the very end of the class, we have a class on warfare, but we're also going to talk about the end of the show because we need.
There's so much to unpack there. Yeah.
So another central theme in our course is exploring how various themes like race and status and sexuality intersect with gender. I'm a gender historian, and that's one of my main interests. So how are the representations of race in this show gendered?
Oh my God, how much time do you have?
I know. I was like, do I ask this question?
So there is so much with like our white heroines being raped or assaulted by men of color or faceless mobs of poor people, which then falls into a whole thing about the concept of white trash that I don't think we really have time to unpack, but is something to consider. Yeah. Timothy Laurie has a great article on how race and gender intersect this way in Dany and Cersei's storylines in particular. And there's another Helen Young that she co-wrote with Stephanie Downs that talks about white aesthetics and Victorian medievalism and the pre-Raphaelite brotherhood and how they gave us this image of the medieval woman that we still have. And she's slender and very white and sensual and long-haired like Dany or Cersei before her head gets shaved. Most of the other women go one of like three ways. Either they reject femininity outright, like Brienne and Arya, or they're threatening in some way. And that's like Ilaria, the Sand Snakes, Miri Mazdoor, or they're slaves or otherwise subjugated. For the men, come back to what Dr. Kavita Finn has said in her write-up of The Bells, which is wonderfully sarcastic, and I loved every second of it, that in Game of Thrones, able-bodied white men who can win face-punching contests are the only acceptable heroes.
Such a great line. So great.
The white men get away with a lot more than men of color and can still be considered heroes. I don't think that the show asks us to think that Grey Worm is a hero at the end of all of it, but somehow Jaime still was and Sandor still was, and they've all somehow redeemed themselves. So pretty much the only non-white men that we're asked to admire are Drogo, who is a badass, but still one of those marauding barbarians who gets tamed by Daenerys, and Grey Worm, who takes that really sudden turn at the very end of the series and just starts like murdering innocent people. And I think they also set up kind of an oppositional thing where we've got the barbaric hordes of Dothraki with the raping and the marauding. And then there's the Unsullied, who are literally castrated in order to make them compliant. And again, all of them are cast as men of color, all of the Unsullied, and they're just as much as an anonymous horde as the Dothraki. So we have two white eunuchs in the show, Varys and Theon, and they get to unpack and deal with the trauma of having been castrated. And Grey Worm is really the only Unsullied who gets to talk about it. And it's mostly in the context of figuring out how he can still be intimate with Missandei.
Yeah, so the last 2 weeks in our class, we've looked at, we did a class on masculinity, eunuchs and castration, and then we did a class on disability, where we also actually ended up talking a lot about masculinity, and also the fact that all of the characters that have a disability in the show or have some sort of impairment are elite. And we don't learn anything about we've talked a lot about how we never learn anything about normal people in this show other than their lives are apparently terrible. And we spend a lot of time thinking about these representations and how they intersect. But in particular, we talked a lot about Grey Worm and how of the three eunuchs on the show, he's kind of represented as the most stereotypically masculine in the sense that he's a fighter, but he's also the one that's represented as being sexual as well. But then the one that ends up having this very troubling storyline at the end, who turns into this murderer, whereas both Varys and Theon get this, as you mentioned, this chance at redemption and this chance to unpack the trauma, but that never happens really with Grey Worm.
Yeah.
And his storyline kind of serves to support Dany again, rather than to further anything.
Yeah, once she's gone, he has nothing left and just like, well, I guess we're leaving.
And yeah, I'm
giving it kind of a short shrift there. It was very much, he and Missandei had talked about going back to Noth, and he's like, even without her, I'm going to go and I'm going to live our dream. And it was kind of sweet, but it felt kind of flat with everything they'd done before that, I think.
Yes, and I can't forgive them for what happens to Missandei.
No, it's
obviously
terrible.
It's just a plot point. Like she becomes this footnote, right? She dies so that we can allow Dany and Grey Worm to go crazy and kill everybody.
And I think the thing that really gets me, to use Gail Simone's terminology, they fridge women all the time on this show. I think it was the putting her back in chains. And Cersei putting her back in chains, when what does Cersei know about or understand about slavery?
Yes.
Like, why coming from her, it makes no sense. But the showrunners put this Black woman who had come out of slavery back into chains to kill her. It's absolutely terrible. It was just,
Yeah, and the fact that she's the only name, like, obviously they'd use her because of her relationship with Dany, but there could have been other people, right? Like,
yeah.
Why not Jorah? Well, he's dead by
Why
then,
does but... Jorah get to go out as a hero?
Yes,
I hate Jorah.
I know, his redemption is very unfair. We later on in the semester, we're going to spend a class thinking about women of power. And I'm talking to Miriam Shattis, who's a historian of queenship, and she has lots of things to say about the way that
I will bet she
power
does.
Is reflected in this show. So just as a way of wrapping up, so what are some final thoughts that you might have about the way that we move forward in thinking about race in Game of Thrones and its impact on our vision of the medieval period?
I think we need to listen to historians of color. It's like the primary thing. I mean, definitely don't let me be the final word on this. I am a middle-aged white woman mm-hmm. who's just done a lot of research. I don't have the lived experience to speak to some of this. And a lot of other people really do and are speaking out really well. I went looking while preparing for this for as many historians of color to kind of name drop and quote in here as I could, because it's them that I want to listen to when we're talking about this kind of thing.
Thank you so much for sharing your work and your ideas about race, gender, and medievalism in Game of Thrones with us today. This is a really insightful conversation, and I think it's going to give my students a lot to think about.
Good.
For a list of the references mentioned by Dr. Carroll, as well as other materials related to race and racism in Game of Thrones, please see our course page, Week 6, Race, Racism, and the White Savior Complex.